Hello and welcome to episode 3 of The Infectious Myth. I'm very pleased to have with me today Dr. Peter Gottschy from Denmark, who is a medical researcher and head of the Cochrane Collaboration in Denmark. Welcome to the show, Dr. Gottschy.
Thank you.
I want to talk to you today about two recent books that you've had published. The first one I've read, which is called Mammography Screening, Truth, Lies, and Controversy. And the second one I have not yet read, but sounds fascinating, Deadly Medicine and Organized Crime. So I thought maybe we could start with the mammography book first, because I'm more familiar with it, and it's a somewhat narrower subject matter. It's not taking on the entire pharmaceutical industry.
Yes.
So you found a lot of harm with mammography. When I first started to read, I thought, well, maybe the harm would be the radiation from mammography, but what you found is actually quite different than that. Can you just briefly explain what's wrong with mammography?
Yes. The harm from the radiation when women go to mammography screening isn't so large. What is much worse is that mammography screening detects a lot of harmless cancers that would never have come to the woman's attention for the rest of her lifetime. But when it gets detected, you have to do something, because you cannot in the microscope or any way else see the difference between a dangerous cancer and a harmless one. So when you have found a cancer, you treat it. And this means that a lot of healthy women, they become cancer patients for no good reason.
So what you're saying is that a lump that's detected through mammography, through radiation, might not actually be growing quickly.
That's what we know, and we have also published research that shows that many of these mammography-detected tumors would have melted away by themselves if they hadn't been treated at all. And we know that this can happen for other cancers, like childhood cancers, that they can melt away even without treatment. So it's nothing new, but it also happens for breast cancer.
That actually was one of the most surprising things in your book. It was totally unknown to me that small breast cancer just disappears. So that if you take a mammogram 1 year, and the next year, you won't see all of the same lumps, all of the same, whatever they are, lumps. Some of them will have disappeared.
Well, I don't know if I understand you correctly, but many of these mammography-detected cancers would have disappeared again, but we know this from statistical analysis we have done, because you treat all of them. So you cannot see in clinical practice that they would have disappeared, because it's rarely that women say, I don't want any treatment, so that you can actually document that some of these cancers disappear.
Okay, you'd have to have a woman who said, okay, you found some lumps, but I want to come back next year for another mammogram, but in the meantime, I'm not going to do anything. The chances are she's going to say, do something.
But we don't even need women saying that, because we know from our statistical analysis that many cancers must disappear again. And I can give you another example. Mm-hmm. The very early cell changes, which we call carcinoma in situ, which means that they are not yet cancer. They are just cell changes. We know that we find so many of these cell changes on screening that few of them would ever have developed into cancer. And yet we even treat these cell changes, and sometimes even by mastectomy, because they can be diffuse so that they are not in one location but in several locations in the breast. Mm-hmm. And many of these early cell changes, they would also disappear by themselves.
That surprised me. I think another term for that is in situ ductal carcinoma. I thought a carcinoma was a cancer, and you're saying that it's a carcinoma, but it's not growing like a cancer.
Yes, it looks like a dangerous cancer in the microscope, but it isn't. And this is one of the things we need to face. And when we treat these healthy women who have harmless cancers with radiotherapy and sometimes chemotherapy, we actually kill some of them. And this is another problem with screening, that treatment of healthy, overdiagnosed women seems to kill as many as screening might save from dying in breast cancer. So overall, as far as I can see, mammography screening doesn't increase the longevity of the women.
So there's no... So when people have looked at the overall death rate of women, they haven't noticed a decline after mammography screening has been instituted.
They haven't noticed what, please?
A decline in overall death rates.
Oh, several people have looked at that, and we have done that ourselves in Denmark, because in Denmark we only had screening in 20% of the country throughout 17 years. So we had a perfect control group, which for 17 years was not invited for screening. So when we compared with the part of the country where we didn't have screening, we couldn't see any difference in breast cancer mortality. We couldn't see any effect of screening. And many people have also looked at whether screening reduces the occurrence of cancers that have spread outside the breast.
Mm-hmm.
This is the whole rationale for screening, to catch cancers early before they have
right.
spread outside the breast. And these studies are quite consistent. They have not been able to show any decrease in advanced cancers. There was a big American study published in New England Journal of Medicine 1 or 2 years ago, which over 30 years had seen a decline of only 8% in advanced cancers. But this could very easily be due to women attending doctors earlier nowadays than they did earlier when they find something in their breast. We have documented that this has happened for Denmark. So this is hardly an effect of screening either.
Right. It's very difficult to look at changes in a population and ascribe it to a particular, to a single change in medical practice, such as...
Well, I know, but we have, for example, Norway, which has introduced screening in a staggered fashion so that they had a control group. And in Norway, they couldn't see any difference in the number of advanced cancers, not the slightest bit.
Yes. Well, let's go through some of the harms that occur to women. You said that the actual radiation dose in a mammogram is not that high. But the first thing that can happen is a woman is falsely diagnosed and then later will be told, okay, it's not a cancer. I mean, is there more than psychological distress that occurs there? And how serious is that?
Yes. One of my colleagues in Copenhagen has published a beautiful study where they developed a questionnaire that actually portrayed the women's concerns. And then they took women who attended screening.
Yes.
And there can be three outcomes. Either you get a cancer diagnosis, or you are
right.
told that you are healthy. There's nothing wrong. And
right.
then there is the middle group, which is told that, well, we are not sure. We must see you again. These
right.
False positives that later gets told that it was cancer.
Right.
Now, what they showed was that even 3 years after a false positive, and after an all-clear message that you are healthy, these women with a false positive had an anxiety level and other psychological disturbances that was in between those who got a breast cancer diagnosis and those who had been told all the time, there is nothing wrong with you. So if you count all these false positives, which are very, very many, in the U.S., it's at least 20% of the women over their lifetime that they get a suspicion of cancer. and it may be even considerably higher. It's actually in Norway, it's only 20%. In the U.S., it may be up to 40%. So it affects a huge fraction of the women. If you count all this psychological anxiety into the equation, then screening is unequivocally harmful for women.
Another thing is that even women who are told later that they don't have cancer may have to undergo a biopsy, and that's fairly invasive for a breast tumor.
Yeah.
And that can cause, apart from the psychological distress, can that cause, like, later pain or scarring or things like that? Or is it... Go ahead.
Yes, you are absolutely right that many women have persistent pain after breast operations. I think I remember some numbers that, was it half of the women that had pain a couple of years after the operation? So it can last a very long time. And it is because of all these harms that an official report from Switzerland in December recommended that screening should be stopped in Switzerland. This is the first country in the world that has been bold enough to say that we should stop this.
And then, of course, women who are told that they do have a cancer will go on, and although I guess treatment is not as aggressive, they're not into radical mastectomy as much as they used to be, but still the removal of part of a breast can leave women with permanent pain and also a feeling of disfigurement, which must also be a psychological cause of distress.
Yes, that's true. There are many harms that we hear very little about, but that we can learn about if we talk to these women.
Right. And according to your book, I can't remember the exact figures, but mammography programs appear to increase the rate of diagnosis of cancer by about 25 or 30%. Is that correct? It varies, I guess, from place to place.
This number is much disputed, and you can arrive at different numbers depending on how you do your research. We did a systematic review of several countries that have introduced a national screening program, and what we came up with was 50% overdiagnosis. So you go from 100 cancer cases to 150. And this means that if you decline the invitation to go to screening, you can lower your risk of getting a breast cancer diagnosis by one-third. That is 50 out of 150. That is one-third.
Right.
So the best preventive measure of not getting a breast cancer diagnosis is, ironically, to stay away from screening.
Which brings the whole thing into question. Now, often a statistic that is often quoted is that the death rate from breast cancer is declining. So can you explain why that's a false and misleading statistic?
Yes, it's terribly misleading. In Denmark, for example, breast cancer mortality declined more in young women who had never been invited to screening than in women who had been invited. And this has been found in many European countries. There is a paper that describes this. So what all this tells us is actually good news for the women, because the good news is that it is the introduction of quite effective treatments like tamoxifen and chemotherapy that has had a dramatic effect on deaths in breast cancer. So also for this reason, if screening has any effect today, it must be much, much smaller than it was 30 years ago when the old trials were made.
Mm-hmm. And so what you would say is that the best thing for a woman to do is looking for lumps yourself the best thing, or should you go to a doctor to have your breast examined? Like, what is the best thing for a woman to find a real tumor that could potentially cause a serious cancer?
Well, not so long ago, both the American Cancer Society and also similar societies in other countries recommended women to examine their breasts once a month.
Right.
But we have done a review on that, and it doesn't lower breast cancer mortality. It doubles the number of biopsies because of a lot of false positive findings, and of course then also leads to more anxiety.
Right.
So self-examination of the breast can definitely not be recommended, and I think that the American Cancer Society no longer recommends it. But if a woman finds something, for example, while when she has a shower, and, mm-hmm. and she thinks this is something new, then of course she should attend a doctor. It has always been like this. This is
right.
the best thing women can do.
And so by finding a lump, you're actually finding a real cancer, not some small thing that might go away.
Well,
another thing that seemed counterintuitive.
Many lumps, they are benign.
Mm-hmm.
So if a woman finds a lump, it's not a sign of cancer. It's just a sign that she should be seen by a doctor.
Yes, and have it looked at. So how would a doctor reliably determine that it is a cancer or not? Would they do a biopsy?
In all the usual ways, she would very likely get not a screening mammogram, but a clinical mammogram,
mm-hmm.
which is very different because now you use a mammogram because of a suspicion of cancer. That's not a screening test.
Right.
And you can also add ultrasound, and you will biopsy the lump and so on.
Mm-hmm.
It's just straightforward.
Yes. So this is all really important information, and you would think that in particular governments that are spending more money than they say they want to be spending on health care and medical treatment, you'd think governments would welcome this, that the medical establishment would welcome this. But one of the things you document is that there was serious pushback against you for publishing this information, for doing this research.
Oh, yes. I have been exposed to all sorts of ad hominem arguments and also accusations that I am responsible for the death of many women and all that sort of thing. I have had it all because some people believe strongly in screening and other people, they earn a lot of money through screening, so they are not objective either. And it's always very difficult to stop a screening program once it has been introduced because politicians, they have invested prestige in it.
Yes.
And there may be voters when there are elections that you can say you do something for the women and all that sort of thing.
Right. It's always the same. It seems like a quick fix to women's health problems is we'll send a bunch of trucks around the country to do mammograms and everybody will be happy.
Yeah. But I can tell you I gave a talk in Oxford in England 1 year ago about the results of mammography screening, and there were 800 people from all over the world. There wasn't a single question about whether they believed what I had presented to them. The questions were about what should we then offer the women?
Right.
And then I told them, come on, you don't offer the men anything, at least not in Europe. We advise strongly against screening for prostate cancer because it is so harmful.
I ask you. Yes, I also looked into the PSA test, which has very similar problems, right, in terms of false positive diagnosis.
Yeah.
And now in North America, we see a dramatic increase in the promotion of prostate cancer screening. Every November, you're supposed to grow a mustache or shave off. I can't remember which one, but it's something to do with a mustache in November. And somehow this mustache is related to prostate cancer. And everybody's supposed to go to the urologist and to get this highly inaccurate test, which will result in the same harms as mammography, excess stress, excess biopsies, excess treatment.
Oh, it's far worse than mammography screening, because many men become permanent impotent and some become incontinent. I mean, this is a terrible way of ending your life.
Well, yes. I mean, it seems like these screenings, I certainly don't think it's intentional, but looking at, magazines, the profile of a woman, their shape, which, you know, is markedly affected by their breasts, of course, is very important to their feeling of beauty and self-worth and feeling of sexuality and all those things. Just like a man's ability to function in bed is psychologically very important. And we're taking this away from people at some point in their life through this screening. It seems a horrible thing to do to people.
Yes.
So what are the economic sort of forces that were against this? We're talking radiologists, the screening programs themselves. Who else was lined up against you when you were doing this work?
Well, many women believe strongly in the screening propaganda, and on television you never see a woman who says, I have been overdiagnosed. Mm. I would have been fine were it not for screening, but now I'm going to die because my radiotherapy actually induced a new cancer, lung cancer, for example, and this is now going to kill me. You have never seen women like that on television, whereas you see lots of women who say, screening saved my life. And, of course, it's not likely that screening saves lives. So the propaganda is huge.
Right. So if somebody is diagnosed with a very, very small tumor, and it's treated, and it was never cancerous, and they survive, they will say, my life was saved.
Yes.
But it might not have been.
This is the paradox of screening, that the more people you harm, the more women will say, I was saved.
Right, because, of course, they believe that this was a cancerous tumor, that it was caught early. I mean, that's the propaganda, if I can use that word, that catch it early and it won't turn into a dangerous cancer. Nobody says catch it early before it regresses back into nothing. Nobody thinks that way.
Yes.
I also read somewhere a paper some time ago that the popular idea about cancers is that they grow exponentially, that you don't have much time. And yet the research I had, this paper had looked at a bunch of research on this and showed that actually cancers tend to grow linearly, not exponentially. Is that your understanding?
Oh, cancer doesn't grow in either way, not permanently. It can grow in an exponential fashion for some time, but at other times it can be more a chaotic process. It's much, much more complicated than people think. But maybe could I talk about, for example, there are sometimes campaigns in your country about check your neck.
I don't think I've heard these, but go ahead, talk about it.
Yeah, but there are campaigns that you should be checked because you might have cancer in your thyroid, and this is really, really bad because studies have shown that we likely, all of us, every single one of us above a certain age, have cancer in our thyroids. But they are totally harmless, almost all of them. So if you start finding them, you will create an enormous amount of harm. And even though I've been a doctor for many years, I have never heard of a single patient who died from thyroid cancer. But we all have it.
Now, so maybe we should talk about some definitions, because I get confused by all of this. I thought a cancer was something that was growing and a tumor was a lump. Like, what is the correct terminology to distinguish between a lump that's relatively static or maybe will even regress versus one that's actively growing that I would call a cancer?
Well, maybe we should invent a new terminology because people think that cancers are always deadly, and this is not the case. And a tumor, let's call it a tumor, that's better.
Yes.
The tumor may be growing for some time, and then it may stop completely and even regress and disappear again.
Right, so the very presence of a tumor obviously is proof that it grew in the past because it wouldn't be there if it didn't grow. But what you're saying is it grew for a few years or a few months, but now it may have stopped, and it may stop for a long time.
Yes, and we have actually known that for many years, even with breast cancer, because at the time where you had this terrible radical mastectomy, quite a number of women actually refused to have the operation. And by so doing, we found out that, in some of these women, nothing happened.
Interesting. I remember my mother, I think, went in for one checkup. I don't know if it was a mammogram or some other checkup. And they found a lump, and she was about 65 at the time. And I wondered at the time, I didn't know much about it. How do we know that lump hasn't been in her breasts since she was 20, in which case it hasn't grown for 40 years? Or
We don't know. And it might actually have been there when she was 20. I looked at some data from the U.S. and from Germany, and actually, under some assumptions that are not too unreasonable, when a cancer is 1 centimeter in size, so that you can detect it on a mammogram, for example, it has been there on average for 20 years. So this idea about detecting something early is also wrong when it has been there for 20 years on average.
1 centimeter, and so if it grew to 2 centimeters in another 20 years.
You can't calculate it so simply because when it has become one centimeter, it doesn't take so long before it becomes 2 centimeters.
Mm-hmm. If it's actually cancerous. But we don't actually know that.
If it still grows. Well, it can look like cancer in the microscope, but we now know that cancer is many things.
Right. And I think we do need new terminology because cancer evokes so much fear. And basically, if you mention cancer, I think the average person is thinking about something that is actively growing and it's growing fast, exponentially, perhaps. And so to talk about a tumor that's not growing is, I think, beyond where most people have gone in their thinking. It's hard for them to get their heads around it after years of propaganda that if you get diagnosed with cancer, you must act quickly because the cancer is growing quickly.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. One other point on your book before we move on to your second book. Screening is better at detecting non-aggressive tumors than aggressive tumors. Is that also what you found?
Yes. And you don't even have to investigate this because this is a purely mathematical phenomenon. If a tumor grows very slowly, it is simply more likely that you will find it than if it grows very quickly. You go to mammography screening regularly, and if a tumor grows very slowly and it is overlooked the first time, then maybe it might be found the next time when it might still have about the same size.
Right.
Whereas if a cancer grows very quickly, it may appear between two screenings, so screening can't do anything.
Right. So in the case of a lump that's around 1 centimeter, around the point at which you can detect it, if it's been there for 20 years, you know, given multiple mammograms, you probably will eventually see it. But if it's just under 1 centimeter and it's aggressive and you miss it 1 year or it's too small to see 1 year, by the time you go the next year, it will already be a problem.
Yes, and you will already have detected it yourself, and you have attended mm-hmm. a doctor. So what you see when people come for screening are mostly these harmless cancers.
Okay, well, I would recommend that anybody read your book, anybody who's interested in this, which I think is just about everybody. They're either half the people in the world are women, and most of the rest of the people in the world have women in their life that they care about. So I would suggest that mammography screening, Truth, Lies, and Controversy is definitely worth reading. It's a bit technical, but you also have a pamphlet that's really available, right? So that people who don't want to read over 300 pages of relatively technical stuff could read the pamphlet.
Yes, we since the information women get all over the world is very misleading, the information they get from authorities and cancer charities and so on is terribly misleading, we decided to write our own information leaflet some years ago, and we have now updated it, and it is on our website, cochrane.dk, and volunteers in many countries have translated it because they found that also in their country the information was misleading. So it exists in Arabic, Russian, the two Chinese main languages, and so on. It exists in many languages.
Okay, well, that's good to know, and I'll put a link to that brochure into the show notes so that people who are listening to this can find it more easily.
Thank you.
Yes, so that was 2012 you published that book, and now in 2013 you've published a book with the title Deadly Medicines and Organized Crime, How Big Pharma Has Corrupted Healthcare. That's pretty strong words for the pharmaceutical industry.
Yes, and the title accurately tells people why I wrote the book.
Because I heard a recent interview where you said that according to the American government definition, the pharmaceutical industry is an organized criminal operation. So can you explain how you reached that conclusion or on what it's based?
Yes, it is something, it's a long word that is abbreviated RICO or RICO, this legislation. And there are certain types of crime like embezzlement and fraud and tampering with witnesses and destruction of evidence and such things that if you do these things repeatedly, it is actually the definition of organized crime. And I found out by Googling the 10 biggest companies in the world that this was, in fact, their business model. And the biggest company of all companies, Pfizer, has also been convicted of organized crime and a conspiracy.
But there's probably a lot that these big drug companies have not been convicted of. They seem to work in a way that influences doctors in a corrupt fashion, doctors and researchers in a corrupt fashion, and very little seems to be done about this. And can you describe how does a drug company go about, say, promoting a medication beyond what the evidence suggests? So it's maybe got more side effects than they'd like to deal with. It's maybe not as effective as they'd like to deal with. How do you get the doctors and the public to believe that it's a good medicine?
Well, there are many ways you do this. One of which is that you manipulate the clinical trials you perform where you test your drugs. Court cases have revealed through opening company archives that there is actually a good deal of cheating with the data that goes on behind the curtains. And this is why independent researchers like me can never get access to the raw data in drug companies because they don't want others to see what they are doing. And I can give you some concrete examples. For example, Merck cheated with Vioxx studies where they withheld cases of heart attacks on Vioxx in their trials, so it took longer before we discovered that Vioxx kills people.
And wasn't Vioxx supposed to reduce the risk of heart disease?
No, not at all. The drugs were supposed to increase the risk of heart attacks through their mechanism of action. But Merck scientists kept that away from public view for many years. And I have calculated in my book that Vioxx probably killed 125,000 people worldwide. Many of whom should never have gotten the drug in the first place because perhaps they had back pain or a tennis elbow or something, and they might equally well have taken paracetamol, a usual painkiller.
Right. Right, or done something like go to physiotherapy or something that doesn't involve drugs at all.
Yeah, yeah.
But I guess people are always looking for the quick fix. Go to the doctor, get a pill to fix your problem rather than trying to understand.
That's true, but the cheating becomes even worse when we go from research to marketing.
Okay, explain
that. And I can use Vioxx as an example as well. When the FDA told Merck that they should tell all American doctors that Vioxx increased the risk of heart attacks, then the very next day, Merck told its huge sales force to tell the doctors the opposite, that Vioxx had only 1/8 the risk of heart attacks as other arthritis drugs. And this was, of course, completely wrong.
And so they just laughed in the face of the FDA and said the opposite of what they've been told to say and the opposite of what was the truth. How did they get away with this?
Well, that's the strange thing, that doctors can have confidence in what the drug companies tell them. Because when you do opinion polls in the general public, where they are asked to rank many industries according to the confidence they have in them,
right,
the drug industry always ends up at the bottom, together with, for example, the tobacco industry, the oil industry, and automobile repair companies.
Right. It's not good company to keep.
Yeah, so how come that doctors have any confidence in what the drug industry tells them? That escapes me.
Well, drug companies spend a lot of money on doctors, right? They buy them dinner, they send them to conferences, they pay them consulting fees. I mean, do you think that has a pretty significant impact?
Yes, and this has been documented, that doctors who are on industry payroll, they are more irrational than other doctors about drugs. They use drugs much more compared to other treatments than drugs that are not on industry payroll. They also use new drugs and far too expensive drugs that have nothing to offer compared to old drugs, where we also know the harms much better because they have been on the market for so long.
Right.
And this has been very well documented. So what the drug industry does is that it buys doctors. It's a sophisticated form of corruption.
Right.
And even in my country, Denmark, which is regarded as one of the least corrupt countries on the whole planet, doctors are corrupted to an unbelievable extent. For example, we have just 20,000 doctors in Denmark.
Right.
But 1,000 doctors are on an advisory board for a company or call themselves consultants for a company. 1,000 doctors.
So 1 out of 20 doctors have some significant relationship with a drug company.
Oh, no, it's far more. That's only one of the relationships.
You're saying one company has 1,000 doctors on the payroll?
Pardon?
Are you saying that there's one company that has 1,000 Danish doctors on some kind of paying them something?
Oh, Not really the same company, but in your own country, there was an example that Forest, that markets antidepressant drugs, they had 19,000 American doctors on their advisory board. Isn't that crazy? 19,000.
It's ridiculous to call it an advisory board. It sounds like a fraudulent front to launder money. I mean, obviously, you're not going to get advice from 19,000 doctors, but you can send them all a little paycheck.
Oh, yeah. That's exactly the point.
Yes. And now, is it true that you said that people don't trust the drug companies, but do people trust their doctors?
Yes.
So if the drug companies pay the doctors and people trust the doctors, even though people don't trust the drug companies, they are getting the drug companies' information when they go to the doctor.
This, you hit the nail here, because this is one of the biggest problems in healthcare, that patients have confidence in their doctor and they transfer this confidence to the prescription they get from their doctor. And
right.
Then they think they get a good and a safe drug because they have trust in their doctor. So what they don't think about is, where did my doctor get his or her information from?
Right, which
from
is...
From the drug industry, which I have no confidence in.
Right. And yet, don't doctors claim that they get most of their information from peer-reviewed literature, but I believe I read a paper that showed that that's not the case, that they get from drug companies.
Oh yeah. that's not how the piano plays, really.
Yes.
Drug marketing is incredibly effective.
Yes, because it makes the drug companies know how to make it easy to get the information. They write nice, easy-to-read articles. They provide lots of marketing literature. And the peer-reviewed literature, even though you can now go on to the computer and get a lot of it, it's a lot more work to go through it than it is to get it all synthesized by their company and forget about all the bias that incorporates.
But, you know, the problem is even worse than what you describe, because we cannot even trust the peer-reviewed literature. Because the drug companies, they do their own trials. Then they have in-house staff that analyze the data, and you can analyze the same data set in many, many different ways.
Right.
So some people have jokingly said, torture your data until they confess.
I see.
And then if the data do not confess even after torture, then the drug company can decide never to tell the world about this trial, but just bury it.
So I wanted to ask you this. So you've criticized meta-analysis. Now, if I wanted to control the data, I would sponsor 100 small studies that would really not provide a lot of statistically significant results because they were so small. And then I would suppress the publication of the small studies that really looked bad, and then I do a meta-analysis on what was left over, which was basically the ones that had positive results. I mean, is that a scam that goes on?
Well, the connection is a little bad, but what I got out of it is that you publish those trials that happen to be positive. Is that right?
Yes, and then you do a meta-analysis of the positive ones and come up with a big positive result.
Oh, yeah. You know, one of my colleagues, a psychiatrist from Oregon, Eric Turner, he has worked for the Food and Drug Administration, and he published a very famous article some years ago where he compared the effect of antidepressant drugs as it looked in published articles. But since he worked at the FDA, he had access to all the trials that the companies had performed, because they are obliged by law to submit all of them to the authorities.
Right.
So what he found out was that what was published exaggerated the effect of the antidepressant drugs by 32% compared to everything the companies had done.
That's a pretty significant increase, especially for a drug that may have almost no beneficial impact. You could manufacture a pretty big benefit by doing things like that.
That's true. these antidepressant drugs are not very effective in the first place. So an exaggeration of 32% is really much.
Yes. Like if you got a 3% benefit from a new psychiatric drug, you'd be it would actually probably be pretty good. What other problems does meta-analysis – well, first of all, meta-analysis means that you basically take a bunch of studies about the same thing and you put them all together and do a new statistical analysis, right, which sounds
yes.
good. So what's wrong with meta-analysis?
Pardon?
What is wrong with meta-analysis?
Well, there is nothing wrong with the method, but you cannot do a good job if the raw material you have is rotten. I mean, you can do the most perfect statistical analysis of the trials you have, but when you only can get access to published trials and not those that are not published and less positive, then you know that your result is biased.
So when the FDA gets all the studies that have been done on a particular drug, that information is not made public?
No, and this is a huge shame also towards the patients who participate in trials in order to benefit science and future patients. So the fact that the FDA won't allow independent researchers access to these unpublished trials is just unacceptable.
And it seemed,
yeah, go ahead. Yeah, it was the same at the European Medicines Agency. They wouldn't allow access to unpublished studies, but then we complained to the European Ombudsman, and after 3 years, they were forced to change their view on this. So now we can get access at the European Medicines Agency.
Yes, but I suspect that trying to control these massive pharmaceutical companies, if you close one loophole, they'll find another. They have so many different tricks to make their drugs look good. And without new medicines, their business plan is shot, right? They're toast.
Well, you shouldn't feel sorry for the drug industry because it's the most profitable industry on earth. I mean, the profit per invested dollar is double as much as the rest of Fortune 500 companies. And the crux of the matter here is that the drug industry should not be allowed to test their own drugs because they have a tremendous conflict of interest. The
right.
difference between an honest data analysis and a not-so-honest data analysis can be worth billions of dollars on the world market. So what we should demand is public testing of drugs.
I mean, made public, so no secret trials that don't get published.
Yes, we should demand public testing of drugs. And then the drug industry could still pay for the trials, but they should have nothing to do with them. I mean, imagine if I was accused in a court case and came up in court with 15 binders of paper and told the judge, here is all the evidence, I have produced it myself. Now tell me if I'm guilty enough or not.
Yes.
I mean, he would laugh. And yet we have permitted the drug industry to be their own judges.
Yes, that's an unfortunate fact. The drug companies seem to have a remarkable control over the governments as well as the journals. I mean, I can understand with the journals, they pay for advertising, so the journals are beholden to the drug companies. But why are governments so malleable when it comes to drug companies?
I have often wondered myself why this is the case, and for countries like the U.S. and my own country, Denmark, it's pretty clear that we earn a lot of money through drug exports. So this is
right.
helpful for the national economy. And if there is anything politicians love, then it is something that is beneficial for our economy.
And I know that in the United States, the big pharma, which I think is the lobbying group for the pharmaceutical industry, is maybe the top funder yes. of congressional and Senate races. So you can get a lot yeah. of money if you're friendly to the drug companies to run as yes. a candidate, which
yeah,
is another form of
corruption.
Yeah, we have
the same problem in Europe.
Yes. And does the mainstream media, I mean, it seems to me the mainstream media doesn't really like to touch these pharmaceutical controversies too much. They don't completely censor it, but it doesn't seem like they're as critical as they should be.
No. This is very strange. Journalists can be very critical when they talk to a politician and ask for a second opinion or talk to another politician. But strangely, when it comes to life and death, our drugs, our diseases, then far too many journalists, they just pick up press releases from drug companies and quite uncritically write a story about that without asking someone who doesn't have a conflict of interest. Is this correct, and are there any downsides to this? That's very strange.
I remember noticing, I don't know when I was a teenager or something, that I always read the newspaper, and I would always read what seemed to be the same article on cancer, that, you know, researchers have discovered in mice that this new drug regressed tumors, and if things pan out, this could be the cure for cancer, or it could bring us closer to a cure for cancer. And after a while, I started to realize that all these articles are basically saying the same thing, that really they've accomplished nothing, but they're promising a lot, and
yes.
you just keep going around in a circle.
Yeah.
And yeah. I don't think that we really get any closer. And I think this is not talking about drugs so much with your mammography book, but what you're saying is that the industry really exists to make money and not to make people healthier. And people in the system who may have started with the desire that they went into a medical, they studied some kind of medical field in university in order to help the world, but what they end up doing is to try to increase the profits of the pharmaceutical company that they work for.
Yes. There are many good people in the drug industry who would really like to help the world, and unfortunately they have bosses that always look at the profits, and then it isn't really terribly important whether you have a lousy drug that perhaps killed too many people, as long as the public doesn't complain too loudly about it and the profits are ensured, then it seems to be okay. It should be the most ethical of all industries, and unfortunately it is very far from this.
Well, in the last maybe 5 minutes of this program, what can the average person do? I think we've painted a pretty bleak picture about the pharmaceutical companies. So what can I do as an individual to make change, maybe in my own life or beyond that?
Oh, I have a lot of suggestions for this in the back of my book. The citizen can do a lot of things. And the first thing is, don't take drugs unless you really need them.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of healthy people take drugs because then they lower their risk a little bit of some harm happening in the future. But most
raise
people,
their risks
or many,
in other places.
Yeah, many people get side effects from drugs, and often they don't even realize it is a side effect. They just think they have become older. So actually their quality of life has deteriorated, but they don't think about that it could be the drugs. So the first
right.
thing is, don't take drugs unless you really need them. For example, I don't take any drugs, although I'm 64 years of age.
Right.
I mean, I don't have diabetes. I don't need insulin. So why should I take drugs? I don't do it.
Yeah, no, I'm totally with you. I'm a few years younger, but I don't take any pills. I try to exercise and eat right? And I think those are very important things.
Yes, and then the next thing you can do is to look up on the internet and read carefully on the package inserts. What are the harms of this drug? If people really read about all the harms, they would be terrified and would stop some of the drugs they are taking.
And if your doctor gives you a pamphlet on a drug, that is not the label you're talking about. Like if you search for the actual technical label on the drug, it's going to be many pages of fine print, but worth reading if you're potentially going to take that drug.
Well, it's not so difficult, and actually the harms are often divided in groups, so that you have common harms that happen in 1 to 10% of the patients, and then a little less common harms and so on. So you can actually see what the drug is doing to you.
Yes, yeah, that's really good advice. And one final thing, we just have a couple of minutes left. So one final piece of advice for people.
One final piece of advice?
Yes, yes.
Well, I think that it's not very comfortable, but actually patients should find out if their doctor gets money from the drug industry or if their doctor attends continuous medical education courses that are financed by the drug industry, because that's not really healthy for this doctor's education or for the doctor's patients. So if you ask your doctor and you find out, well, yes, this doctor accepts money from the drug industry and also accepts visits by drug salespeople, which is harmful because you don't hear the truth from them, then you can find yourself another doctor.
Yes. Well, that's all good advice, and I'm sure there's much more in your book. The first book people should consider reading is Mammography Screening, Truth, Lies, and Controversy, and the new book, Deadly Medicines and Organized Crime. And Dr. Gottschalk, I'd really like to thank you for being with me today. I've learned a lot from talking with you, and I think our audience will also learn a lot and hopefully get people to start thinking for themselves more about their own healthcare and not taking the word of their physician for every drug that comes down the pipe.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much for being here today.